good to see everyone here this morning. We do have some visitors with us, and as always, we're very honored to have you with us and hope that you profit from the time you spend with us in this hour of worship to our Lord. If you would turn there to the passage that was read in your hearing a moment ago in Luke chapter 9, verses 28 through 36. This is Luke's account of what is commonly called the transfiguration of Christ. Most of the miracles that Jesus performed were, in many respects, rather flashy. They often got a lot of attention. Even in those cases where Jesus may have tried to do it quietly and not draw attention to it, word would get out and everybody would know what had happened, and it was a really big deal. And that the miracles of Jesus, of course, is what attracted a great following for him. The story of the transfiguration on this occasion, though, does not fall into that category. So far as we know, nobody knew what had happened. In fact, we were told here in verse 36, they kept quiet. The few witnesses that saw what happened here on this occasion were so dumbfounded by what they had witnessed that they couldn't tell a word about this. Now, later on, as we'll be noticing in just a moment in our lesson, they would talk about it, but not here. And so if the miracles of Christ were for the purpose of confirming the word that he was preaching and establishing him as the Son of God, then this miracle really doesn't quite fit that pattern because nobody knew about it. Except, of course, four people. Jesus himself, the one who was transfigured, and then the three apostles who were with him, Peter, James, and John. So what I'd like for us to do this morning is to talk a little bit about this incident, the transfiguration of Christ, and let's try to better understand what this was all about and what kind of practical lessons we might can draw from it for our purpose today. I think it's important for us, in order to really understand what this miracle was all about, to place it in the larger context of Jesus' ministry, what else was happening during this period of time. As best as we can determine, looking at both Luke's account and then Matthew's and Mark's account of the same event, and placing it in the timeline of Jesus' life, it appears that this occurred some 6 or maybe 8 months before Jesus died. In other words, a lot of his ministry had already transpired, and now he was, as we would say today, coming down the home stretch. But there was a little bit more here that plays a role in what was happening here. If you look back in the first part of this chapter, verses 10 through 17, we have Luke's account of the feeding of the 5,000. This, by the way, is the only miracle that is found in all four of the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the feeding of the 5,000. But John's account of this miracle reveals a detail that the other three do not mention. And that is the aftermath of this miracle. You recall in John's account that these thousands, these throngs who had been fed by the few loaves and fishes, continued to follow Christ. They followed him on around the Sea of Galilee to the other side of the sea, continuing to clamor for more handouts is what it amounted to. And Jesus knew what their motive was in following him. And he basically said, no, you're not getting any more. The food that I have to offer that is really meaningful is a spiritual food. And you're only after the loaves and fishes. And I'm not going to give it to you. And we're told in the latter part of John chapter 6 that from that point on, many of his disciples turned away and followed him no more. Scholars call this the collapse of the Galilean campaign. All the popularity that Jesus had enjoyed up to this time evaporated. And from that point forward, Jesus went into what could be considered a rather dark period in his ministry. The crowds, for the most part, were gone. The kind of enthusiasm that he enjoyed in the past among those that were hearing his preaching and teaching just wasn't there anymore. And so from that, during that period of time, including this period of time that involves the transfiguration, we have Jesus spending a lot more time in more remote places with just his apostles. And you have to understand the apostles were slow learners. It took them a long time to figure out what this whole thing was about. Not just the transfiguration, but the coming of Christ, his ministry, what he was trying to accomplish. They didn't get it. And so Jesus spent these last few months of his ministry spending a lot more quality time with his apostles, trying to teach them, trying to ground them, trying to bring them up to a level of understanding so they could grasp what this was all about. Jesus knew, of course, that the ordeal that he was about to go through in Jerusalem was going to be devastating to these men. And they were going to need all the encouragement that they could get to help them survive what was about to happen. And, of course, Jesus himself was more aware of his impending fate, what was about to come up. He knew from the beginning how all this was going to end, but that was off in the future. You know how it is when an unpleasant responsibility is looming closer and closer on your appointment book, you begin to sweat it. And that's what Jesus was going through at this point in his ministry. So, look in verse 22 of this chapter. We're told for the first time, or the apostles are told for the first time, the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed and be raised the third day. This was a new angle. The apostles had not been exposed to this before, but now it looks like all the hoopla, all the grandeur on all the buzz surrounding Jesus and his coming and the coming of the kingdom and all of that, it sounded like it was going to come crashing down. And this talk about him going to Jerusalem and being rejected and killed and raised the third day. Now to us this makes perfect sense because we know how it all turned out. To them, this was just beyond the pale. They could not grasp, they could not understand what Jesus was talking about. And so everything is really riding on the knife edge here. You know, this thing can go one way or the other very easily. And it's in that context, in that setting, in that framework, that the transfiguration of Christ takes place. He takes not all the apostles, but just three of them, Peter, James, and John. And by the way, these are the same three that Jesus took with him in the Garden of Gethsemane. He took all the apostles into the garden. He took these three and went on further into the garden. And there prayed fervently to God. Well, it's these same three men that are with him here. Now, I don't know that we can call these three Jesus' favorite apostles necessarily, but there was something unique about these three that Jesus felt like he could confide in them more so than the others. And so these three were privileged to see something that nobody else got to see. And so he took them up on a mountain in verse 28 and began praying. And we're told that as he prayed, verse 29, the appearance of his face was altered. Matthew and Mark's account says that he was transformed. And his robe became white and glistening. And behold, two men talked with him who were Moses and Elijah, who appeared in glory and spoke of his decease or departure, which he was about to accomplish at Jerusalem. But Peter and those with him were heavy with sleep, and when they were fully awake, they saw his glory and the two men who stood with him. And then Peter went on and talked about making tabernacles for these. But put yourself in the shoes of Peter, James, and John in seeing this transpire in front of their eyes. It had to be an unnerving experience. So all the things that they are dealing with at this point seem to be pushing in the direction of a disappointment. But what they experience here was designed by God, I'm convinced, to get them over this period of disappointment and despair. They are going to need, in days and weeks to come, the encouragement and the strength that this event would give them. There are three components that we want to notice here about what they witnessed on this occasion. The first component is obviously the miracle itself, the transfiguration or the altering of his appearance. This word that is used in Matthew and Mark's account of transfigured is the same word that's used in Romans chapter 12 and verse 2, from which we get our English word metamorphosis. In Romans 12, Paul talked about, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. That word transformed there is the same word that's used here. He was altered, he was transformed, he was changed. Of course, Paul is talking about a spiritual or a moral transformation. What these apostles saw here, what they witnessed Jesus experiencing, was a physical transformation. There was something about his physical appearance that was so drastically altered that he became otherworldly to them. There was definitely something different that had happened here to Jesus. What this was a brief glimpse of the heavenly splendor that awaited him. Not just that awaited him in the future, but that he probably enjoyed before he came to this earth. So these three men were privy to a glimpse of what Jesus was eventually going to enter into, his heavenly glory. So that was the first of the three components. The second component that we see here is the fact that he was talking with two men, who were Moses and Elijah, verse 30. Now, of course, the question arises, how did they know it was Moses and Elijah? I don't think it was they recognized their portraits from their Sunday school literature. No doubt it had something to do with the nature of the conversation that they were engaged in with Jesus. There were enough clues in what these men were talking about that they could identify that must be Moses and that must be Elijah. Wow. How many men in that day and time got to actually see Moses and Elijah? Oh, they knew all about these men. They had heard about their stories and their exploits and everything about the great courage that they had shown in doing God's work in their generation. But how they actually get to see these two men themselves in person? They're talking with Jesus. Why Moses and Elijah? You go back through the Old Testament, all the Old Testament heroes, there are all kinds of people that we could posit as potential candidates for this role of talking to Jesus here on this occasion. But why these two men? Well, remember that Moses was the one who led the Israelites out of Egypt into the land of Canaan, or up to the land of Canaan. Moses was the great lawgiver. He was the one who went up on Mount Sinai and through whom God had given the law to the children of Israel. In fact, Moses' role in that giving of the law was so crucial that it became known as the law of Moses. Moses was the lawgiver, the one through whom it was given. And notice also that Elijah was one of the great prophets of the Old Testament. And it was Elijah who God raised up during the days of Ahab and Jezebel when they had taken over the northern kingdom of Israel. And in fact, their influence through marriage was now infecting the southern kingdom of Judah. And Jezebel, through her campaign of actively trying to destroy all the prophets of God and introduce Baal worship among God's people, and very nearly succeeded in that. And it was Elijah who pretty much single-handedly stood up against that effort and held it at bay. And the nation was saved because of the efforts of this man Elijah. But notice also that he is the premier among the prophets. In the New Testament, we read quite often of the Old Testament consisting of the law and the prophets. And so what do you have here? In these two men, you have the representatives of the law, Moses, and the prophets, Elijah. But actually, there are other things that we might can point to that would help us understand why Moses and Elijah were the two men who were talking to Jesus, because these two men had a number of things in common with Jesus that nobody else had. For example, all three of these men, Jesus, Moses, and Elijah, had some key experiences in their life that involved a period of 40 days. You remember that Moses went up on the mountain, Mount Sinai, for 40 days and nights, and it was there that God gave him that law. It was Elijah who went into the wilderness for 40 days to flee the wrath of Jezebel. And it was in that period of time that he came into the presence of God, who encouraged him and told him to, appeared to him in the small breeze and said, "Go back. You have work that still needs to be done." And of course, Jesus began his ministry by going into the wilderness for 40 days and nights, there to be tempted of Satan. So all three of these men shared this deeply, intensely spiritual experience of spending 40 days and 40 nights in the wilderness to prepare them to do the work that lay in front of them. They had a close connection with God through that experience that few others have had. But another thing that these three men had in common is the way that they departed this earth. There was something unique and unusual about all three of them. Moses, you remember, accompanied or led God's people through the wilderness right up to the border of the Promised Land, and because of a mistake that he had made earlier, he was not allowed to cross over the River Jordan into the land. But God, in commemoration of the service that this good man had provided to his people, took him up on Mount Nebo, where he allowed him to look across the river at the Promised Land. From one end to the other, he could see it all from up there on the top of that mountain. And we're told that there on that occasion, Moses died and God buried him, and no man knows the place of his burial to this day. I don't know of any other Bible character whom God personally laid in his grave as he did Moses. It was a testament to the man's faith, his courage, his service, and God's plan that God performed that service for him. Elijah is the one, you'll recall, that when his time came, he actually ascended into heaven on chariots of fire, and Elisha, his assistant, saw him ascend into heaven. And it had to be a transforming event for Elisha to witness this, but Elijah, again, was unique in that respect, in the way that he left this earth. And then, of course, Jesus, we're all familiar with his story. He was crucified, and 3 days later, he arose from the dead, never to die again. And 40 days beyond that, he ascended into heaven, where now he sits at the right hand of God. So all three of these men had a unique way of leaving this earth that nobody else had. And then, there's one other thing, of course, that we can say about all three of these men that they shared in common, and that is that they, in many respects, at certain points in their life, they each stood virtually alone in doing God's work. All three of them knew what it meant to stand their ground and look the multitudes in the eye and say, "You shall not pass. This is not the way it's going to be." And it took an unusual degree of courage for each of these men to do what they did. But they did it. And they knew what it was like to have to stand there and take the bullets and the slings. So all three of these men had something that, a bond that they shared together. And notice that Luke says that they were, what were they talking about? Verse 31 says, they spoke of his decease, or some translations say his departure, which he was about to accomplish at Jerusalem. The topic of their discussion, whatever the words that were spoken, again, we're not given a transcript of what took place here, but in general, the conversation revolved around what Jesus was about to go through. Now, there are a couple of ways to look at this, and that is, this was the fulfillment. What Jesus was about to accomplish at Jerusalem was the fulfillment of everything that Moses and Elijah, again, all the law and the prophets, had been pointing to. Everything that these men, Moses and Elijah, had fought and lived and died for was leading up to the coming of Christ and the work that he was going to perform. Another thing that we might recognize here is that these men were the representatives of the righteous dead of times gone by. The book of Hebrews talks about the fact that There are those, the spirits of righteous men made perfect, those who were awaiting their ultimate reward. And no doubt Moses and Elijah were in that group, and they're talking to Jesus about this. But there were words of personal reassurance and support from these men because of what they were about to go through, or what he was about to go through. This was not going to be an easy ordeal for him. But Elijah and Moses could talk to Jesus in person and say, "We know what you're going through. We understand it. And you can do it." Now, I know that sounds a little sacrilegious. Hey, they're talking to the Son of God here. Does he really need that? Surely if anybody can withstand the hardship and the temptation and the desire to quit, surely the Son of God could resist that. Well, don't be so quick. You remember what happened in the Garden of Gethsemane when the moment came and Jesus was face to face, as it were, with Satan. And the temptation was the strongest it had ever been in his life to turn and run. He was fighting the temptation to quit so hard that he began to sweat, and the sweat fell as drops of blood. That was how hard it was for him to push back on this temptation. It was not easy. And I have to think that one of the things that helped Jesus find the courage to see this thing through at the end was the knowledge of what he had gone through 6 or 8 months before when he was talking with Moses and Elijah. They did it. I can do it too. And then there is a third element that we want to consider in this story, and that is the reaction of Peter especially, the apostles who are there who have witnessed all of this. Let's look again at verse 33. "It happened as they were parting from him that Peter said to Jesus, 'Master, it is good for us to be here. Let us make 3 tabernacles, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah,' not knowing what he said. While he was saying this, a cloud came and overshadowed them, and they were fearful as they entered the cloud. And a voice came out of the cloud saying, 'This is my beloved Son, hear him.'" "Let us make 3 tabernacles, Peter said, 'one for you, one for Moses, one for Elijah.'" Now, that's why some think this is probably around the time of the Feast of Tabernacles. And that was one of the rituals involving this feast, was to build these little huts that indicated the temporary, transitory nature of God's people as they were journeying through the wilderness on their way to the Promised Land. And perhaps this is what motivated Peter to offer this suggestion here. Let's build these little tabernacles or huts, one for each one of you three, to commemorate you all. But then, notice what happened in response to Peter's request. This cloud descends upon them, and the cloud in verse 34 descended upon them, and they were fearful as they entered the cloud. And we're not told this, but the clear connection here is to the Shekinah glory. That's the Hebrew name given to this cloud that indicated the presence of God. You remember in the wilderness when the Israelites completed the building of the tabernacle and they put it all together according to God's plan, and they commemorated it. They dedicated it to God. This was the official beginning of this Levite worship and the altar and the sacrifices and the Holy of Holies, and all that was complete for the first time that this cloud descended upon the tabernacle. And it was a depiction to the Israelites that God had accepted what they had built, and now He dwelt among them. And this cloud was the representation of God dwelling among His people. The same thing happened when Solomon built the wonderful temple in Jerusalem. At the dedication ceremony, same thing. The cloud came down out of heaven and inhabited this temple. And it was a symbol to the people that, again, God had accepted what they had built for Him. And He now dwelt among them in this permanent dwelling place in Jerusalem. But more than the cloud was the voice that they then heard in verse 35. "Voice came out of the cloud saying, 'This is my beloved Son, hear him.'" Two things in the voice that was spoken here. The first one, "This is my beloved Son," I think was spoken by God for Jesus' benefit. Jesus was struggling at this point. Am I up for this? Can I do this? Do I really want to follow through on this? And here on this occasion, when Jesus needed it the most, He got a reassuring word from His Father. "You're all right, Son. You're my Son. I'm proud of you. You're doing fine." You know, it does a young man a lot of good to hear that from his father. And Jesus needed to hear that here. And right when he needed it the most, his father stepped in and gave him the encouragement that he needed. But then also notice that the voice said, "Hear him." Now that was not addressed to Jesus. That was addressed to Peter and James and John. Peter wanted to build tabernacles, one each, for Moses and Elijah and Jesus. And God said, "You listen to my Son. In the past, you've listened to Moses and Elijah and the rest of the law and the prophets. Now, you listen to my Son. He is speaking for me. You follow him. You dedicate your life to him. Everything else falls away because Jesus is the one that you need to be listening to. He is my Son." So, forever, this puts an end to the idea that Jesus is somehow co-equal or just another in a long list of prophets sent from God to His people. There was a Moses, good for his day. There was Elijah, good for his day. And, oh, there's Jesus, good for his day. No. All the others prior to this pass away. They pale in significance to the one now that God has sent, who is not just another prophet. This is His Son. His own Son He has sent now. You listen to Him. And I can't think of a better way to describe the position that we need to recognize that Jesus offers today. He is God's representative upon earth. In fact, He is God's Son upon earth, and we must listen to Him. Moses and Elijah were great men, no doubt. The law and the prophets that they gave Israel had served its purpose, but now they had been replaced by something greater. And that was God's Son. So what's the significance of the Transfiguration? Well, obviously, for Jesus Himself, there was a great significance. What happened on this occasion and the words that His Father declared to Him on that occasion were a vindication of His life's work. Everything that He had done leading up to this point, and that would eventually culminate in a few months' time in His death and resurrection in Jerusalem, was part of a master plan, and Christ was performing according to that plan. And so this was a message from the Father to His Son saying, "Keep going. You're doing the right thing. I'm proud of you. Let's finish this thing." So it was a vindication of the work that Christ had done. And it renewed Jesus' determination to carry through with the mission that He had come to this earth to accomplish. Right here in Luke chapter 9, in fact, skip down and look at verse 51. "And it came to pass, when the time had come for Him to be received up," notice the wording here, "that He steadfastly set His face to go to Jerusalem." He didn't just meander off in the direction of Jerusalem. He set His face. He steadfastly set His face. He was determined. You could see the grim determination on His face. "I am going to see this thing through." And it's what happened in the first part of this chapter that helped set that resolve in His heart and His mind that He was going to finish this out. For the apostles, there was a restored confidence in this period of discouragement when they saw all the crowds melting away and they no longer had all the enthusiasm that they had seen before among the multitudes. There was now a restored confidence in Christ as the Son of God. They saw in Jesus Christ and this transfiguration, this direct message from God, this is the real deal. We're not following a charlatan here. They saw Jesus transfigured, this image of the heavenly glory, and they heard this voice from heaven declaring God's approval of this man. Never again would they ever harbor any doubts about Jesus and who he was and what he represented. In fact, many years later, the Apostle Peter, not long before he died, penned the epistle that we now know as 2 Peter. If you would turn to 2 Peter chapter 1 and look at what he wrote in verses 16 through 18. Now, during the time that Peter wrote this epistle, the church has been in existence for several decades now, and the churches are beginning to feel some pressure. Persecution is beginning to heat up. There are false teachers that are beginning to circulate among the churches and wreaking havoc, and there are all kinds of pressures and problems that the brethren, the churches, are having to deal with now that they've not had to deal with before. And Peter writes to these churches now, and notice what he says, beginning in verse 16. "We did not follow cunningly devised fables when we made known to you the power and coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, but were eyewitnesses of His majesty. For He received from God the Father honor and glory when such a voice came to Him from the excellent glory, 'This is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased.' And we heard this voice which came from heaven when we were with Him on the holy mountain." Now, of all the experiences that the Apostle Peter had with Jesus, and there were a lot, all the miracles that Jesus performed, raising Lazarus from the dead, there are so many things that Peter could have pointed back to convince these people, "We do not follow cunningly devised fables," but there was one thing that stood out in Peter's mind, and that was what he witnessed on the Mount of Transfiguration. When he saw the glory of the Father upon Jesus in that transformation, when he heard the voice of the Father himself speak from heaven, "This is my beloved Son in whom I'm well pleased," that left an indelible mark on Peter's mind that would never leave him. Now, to be sure, Peter made some mistakes along the way, but at the end, he clung to this experience, this incident on the Mount of Transfiguration, as the solid evidence of who Jesus was, and the fact that if we bank everything on Him, then we'll come out all right. Because this is not a fable. This is not a fairy tale. This is the real deal. And Peter had the experience of the Transfiguration to support that. And then for us today, what is the significance of the Transfiguration for us today? Well, as we've just read in 2 Peter, there are a couple of things that we can draw from this incident. Number one is that it is further evidence for the validity of our faith. We are not following fairy tales or fables here. The Apostle Peter would give his life in defense of what he saw on that occasion, what he witnessed, then it's enough for us to follow as well. Now, of course, there's something else that plays a role here, and that is the resurrection of Jesus. That was an even greater miracle. But even before you get to the resurrection and talk about that, you've got to deal with the transfiguration here. What happened on this occasion? And why did it happen? This was not God's effort to try to convince vast throngs of people by some big splashy miracle that Jesus was the Son of God. There was something more intimate, something more personal here. And now through the witnesses that saw it, we have the record of what happened. And this is a further piece of evidence of the validity of our faith. We have our faith built on solid ground when we acknowledge Jesus as the Son of God and follow Him. But then a second thing. Jesus personally experienced the glory that was to come when he went through this transfiguration. These three apostles that witnessed it saw a glimpse with their own eyes of this glory that they someday would share. And now through the testimony of what they've given to us, we have something to look forward to. This is what's going to happen to us someday. We're going to be resurrected. Our bodies shall be transformed, transfigured into a spiritual reality, spiritual form that we cannot possibly begin to appreciate in the mortal bodies that we inhabit now. we have something to look forward to. And what we read here in the story of the transfiguration of Christ is just a little peek, a little glimpse of the future that awaits us. Someday all of us are going to see Christ in even greater glory than this little snippet that we've been given here. And we're also going to see Moses and Elijah and Peter and James and John and all the other heroes of the Old and New Testaments as we stand before the throne of God. And if we have done what God declared and commanded on this occasion that we should be doing, that is, hear Him. Listen to Jesus. Follow Him. Let Him be our guide in this life. If we have done that in this life, then we will share the glory that He experienced on this occasion. If you're here this morning and you have not been doing a very good job in your life of hearing and following Jesus, it's not that God expects perfection. Dan addressed this in his excellent comments before the Lord's Supper this morning. God's not expecting or demanding perfection of you. He knows He's not going to get that. But He does want you to the very best of your ability, in your heart of hearts, to dedicate yourself to do the best you can to follow Him. You make mistakes, own up to it, fix it, and go on. And Jesus died in order that your sins and mistakes can be forgiven. Won't you take advantage of that gift? Accept His salvation. Commit your life to following Him. If you need to respond to the Lord's call in any way, we encourage you to come forward and make your need known as we stand and sing the invitation song.
Would you be free from the burden of sin? There's power in the blood, power in the blood. Would you or evil a victory win? There's wonderful power in the blood. There is power, wonder-working power.
Power in the blood.